Welcome to Season 3, Episode 1 of Jesus in Montreal, a podcast of the Presbyterian College. Through this podcast, we are exploring the theme of Christian identity in Montreal. We are sharing stories of faith and music and mission and culture in this unique context. We're asking, where is Jesus alive and bringing hope and joy and transformation in the city? Our host is Roland DeVries, principal of the college, and our guest for this episode is Glenn Smith. Glenn currently serves as director of the Master of Theological Studies program at the Presbyterian College. Glenn has been an important leader within the evangelical and Protestant context of the church in Montreal for decades, and is keenly interested in how the church in Quebec should engage with the reality of secularism. Glenn has just published a new book entitled Christians in the City of Montreal with Bloomsbury Publishing, a reflection on faith and mission in the city, both today and across its history. We are pleased to welcome Glenn for this episode of Jesus in Montreal.
Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, Roland.
Yeah, welcome to Jesus in Montreal, this podcast of the Presbyterian College. And we're here at the college, actually. We thought about doing this offsite, but here we are at the college up in the classroom and looking forward to this conversation. We're here because of the publication of your book here in my hands, Christians in the City of Montreal, which is part of a series by Bloomsbury. And we're going to talk about the book and some of the content more that arises out of it. But before we get there, the first question I always ask in these podcasts is something about Montreal. I mean, we're in Montreal. This is our city. This is the podcast is all about Jesus in Montreal. The book is about Montreal, and maybe it's about Jesus in Montreal too. And so the first question is always about Montreal and your relationship to Montreal. So tell me, what is your favorite thing, your favorite place about this city?
Well, it's a great question. I have been working in Montreal since 1975, and I've lived here since 1980. So I could be crucified if I didn't mention right up front, well, I love hockey. And so hockey is what I like. I just love it. But I have to admit that over all these years, because of my vocation and my training, I love Montreal neighborhoods. Hmm. I love walking them. I did my first studies in ethnography in Montreal in 1975 and 1976. I keep doing them to this day. Two other things I really love about the city is jazz. Great jazz festival we have every year. But I think one thing that I discovered as I was doing my research, how important the Great Peace of Montreal of 1701 is. Hmm. And I go back to that site in Old Montreal whenever I'm in the old city. So I just love my city. Yeah. It's great. It's a great city.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, it's interesting. Everybody gives different answers to that question, obviously. So many things we could talk about in terms of, you didn't say the Habs, but obviously the Habs are a part of what you're referencing there. So yeah, thank you for that. We're talking about the book, as I said. And so I thought we'd start with a couple of questions that are, you know, sort of the typical, in a way, the typical questions you have to answer when you submit a book proposal even, right? So we won't go into the dryness of a book proposal, but I guess the first question, though, is why did this book need to be written?
Well, start off on the more technical side. You know, this is one of 25 books in a series on urban global Christianity. So in global Christianity, we're always looking at what Andrew Wells always taught us about the indigenous principle and the pilgrim principle. So the indigenous principle is that we all live in a place. Hmm. But the pilgrim principle is we're following Jesus, and that's global. So I was really interested in contributing to the series when they asked me to write this one about, you know, what is actually going on in Montreal that is all part of global Christianity. Hmm. I came to the conclusion that I want to tell a different story. Hmm. The classic story right now is the church is in decline for lots of people. They hope it disappears quickly. And I wanted to tell the story that I think there's another thing to look at here. And that's that Christianity is alive and well. It's smaller. It's much more robust. So I wanted to change the discourse. But I think the other reason is I'm mostly writing to Christians in Montreal, but there's always researchers that want to know more about this. So that's why I spent hours and hours in the archives. But all of a sudden I found through just contacts that Christians in other French-speaking cities in La Francophonie, this will be a unique contribution. There's not much about Christians in French-speaking cities. So maybe there'll be some rebound effects.
Right.
But that's,
right.
You know, I want to tell a different story.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. And that's interesting. I mean, in the church in Montreal, well, across Christendom, really, post-Christendom context, we all have this sense of decline, and it's very easy to let that narrative be the defining narrative. Yeah. And so we'll talk a little bit about some of that as we go on. But I like that idea that there's a different story. Yeah. And often that story comes from precisely from being on the ground.
Well, exactly. And that's kind of the fun part about being an ethnographer is that, you know, stats can tell us what they want, but that's not the full story. And so through all the interviews and through all the exchanges and through the firsthand research, I discovered things that I just never knew before. And so I was interested, you know, what are the factors that are going on in the first quarter of the 21st century that have led the church to be so robust and alive while everybody is planning for its funeral?
Yeah, telling another story. Wait a minute. Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. Interesting. And who is it for? You mentioned briefly it's for Christians in Montreal, but for a broader audience. So who do you have in mind as you're writing?
Oh, well, I was thinking about that almost every day as I was writing. I wanted to write for Christians in the city. Hmm. And by Montreal, I'm talking about the greater metropolitan area. So the 4.3 million people. That I wanted to give a message of hope. I wanted to say there's a different way of looking at what's going on in culture, and it's not bad, and it's not as bad as everybody thinks. And so that's my first audience. But then because of who Bloomsbury is and because of this series, there's lots of research going on global Christianity, not much on urban global Christianity. So I wanted to be writing for people so that we get beyond the classic stories of decline and marginalization.
Yeah, so, no, great. Yeah. Thank you for that. So one of the questions that I thought would be interesting to talk about is the question of conversion. And in a way, you know, we're talking about the granular nature of Christianity, right? The on-the-ground reality of faith, contrary perhaps to what the grand narrative says. And it seems like the most concrete expression of that is actually conversion narratives. It's not only that.
Yeah.
It's how the church lives out that faith after a conversion or after being raised in the church. But conversion gets us pretty close to the nitty-gritty of faith in our context today. Yeah. And so you pick up on the question of conversion, both because conversion matters for Christian life and faith, also because you're in dialogue with Charles Taylor, who has this very interesting, curious concluding chapter to his work on secularism that's about conversion, about this remaining possibility. So he writes this whole book about how hard it is, nearly impossible to be a person of faith, and then he has his concluding chapter on conversions. And you share some stories, both of a conversion. You tell the story of someone by the name of Violaine Paradis, and you look also at the work of a number of researchers, including a student of yours and a student of practical theology, Loic Richard, about this possibility of conversion. And you're telling stories of conversion in the same way, in a sense, that Charles Taylor is telling this impossible thing continues to happen. And that's interesting all by itself. But one of the questions I wanted to touch on as we think about conversion is the reality of what Taylor calls and you refer to as cross pressures.
Yeah.
This whole idea that it's really hard to be a person of faith in our context, that there are these deep cultural tensions that sort of militate against being a person of faith. In relation to that, both from Loic Richard's work and from the story you share of Violaine, it takes time for people to come to faith. It unfolds over time. And I guess the question bringing these things together is, how are people who are coming to faith dealing with these cross pressures, this difficulty of holding a faith when so much militates against it in our context and in unique ways in the Quebec context? Well, what would you say about that? How are they responding to those cross pressures?
No, so let's go back to the context and Charles. In my interviews with him for the book, we talked about conversion. And I said to him in one of the interviews, I said, why did you include this chapter? And he laughed and he said, I'm not quite sure. I've come to the conclusion, and I've told this to him. I said, I really think that chapter is, it's your story. That's what's happened to you. And he said, oh, you're probably onto something. You know, it's probably about as decisive as I could get him to be. I think what we need to remember, and we'll get to the cross pressures here, is that in Taylor's writing, and I think he's right, we live in the eminent frame. So that it's possible to live with no appreciation or understanding of the transcendent. We can slough it off and we can try to find human flourishing in the eminent frame. And we all live in the eminent frame. So conversion then becomes, in Taylor's words, how you live in the eminent frame. And so he would contend, and I would think biblically, you can't make the case. You cannot convert and stay in the autonomous self. There's something transcendent that's wonderful. That's why I love Bart's expression on conversion. It's an awakening. The cross pressures are real. And I think that's why conversion takes a long time. I mean, the conversion of the cross pressures in Montreal for Roman Catholics are the sexual abuse cases, the residential schools, and that they tried to cover it up. And that had huge effects on parishes in this city, and therefore on Catholics. Protestants feel marginalized, so the cross pressures become anything that wants to get faith out of the public domain. Most people, in my opinion, deal with these cross pressures by muzzling themselves. They'll just say, well, I'm going to follow Jesus. I'm going to read my Bible. I'll go to church, but I'm going to do it on my own. But I say, no, you're buying into the hyper-individuality of the eminent frame. And so, therefore, we need to take conversion so much seriously that it's a whole life conversion. It affects every area. And that's why I think vocation becomes so important in the secular age, that we then decide through conversion to follow Jesus and then to live it out in every area of our life, banishing the silos. The story of VLN is so wonderful. I met her through my wife because they were both community development organizers in the borough of Hochelaga-Maisonneuve. And so I sat down with her, and for 3 hours, she explained her life experience to me. Growing up in a very nominal Roman Catholic family in Ville-Saint-Laurent, and discovering St. Francis of Assisi. And then she goes on to talk about leaving her work in the arts and in cinema. She went on a trip, discovered the Sisters of the Congregation de Notre Dame. And it took over 4 years before she decided that she would follow Jesus. Loic, in his research on conversion, he was studying the conversion of young adults. And he found that it was taking anywhere between 5 to 8 years for somebody after they started to first think about it. And Loic discovered that one of the big things that helped was exposing people who were in the eminent frame to be exposed to other Christians and to get involved in small groups related to a church. But when you listen to Charles Taylor's conversion, which I document in that chapter, it was university students, first of all here at McGill, then at Oxford, the student Christian movement, and they got him to start reading the Bible. So the ways are rather quite simple. But because of the cross pressures and the power of the eminent frame, we just have to be much more patient in this process.
Right. And I wonder if a part of that is, like, we go back to Violaine's story, you know, she found her faith within within a community, right? The centered on practices, centered on a rhythm of life. That's something that the Roman Catholic tradition, some of the high Anglican communities, alternative based communities like the one she was initially involved in. It's on the evangelical side, the mainline Protestant side, we have a lot harder time forming those kinds of communities. So we're still sort of centered on the individual as needing to express this faith, live this faith, embrace this faith on their own as an individual in the face of all of these challenges. And so I think another side of this maybe is that we haven't been in the Protestant, evangelical, Anglo, and Francophone, I suppose, sides about forming communities in which we really find our identity through those practices in life together.
I particularly think that evangelicals have the biggest challenge in this area. And that'll maybe come as a big surprise to a lot of people and to a lot of our listeners. But I say that for this reason. Evangelicals are big about being born again.
Right.
And their tagline on this one is, you have to have a personal relationship with God through Jesus Christ by the power of the Spirit. So they get the nomenclature right. But in the eminent frame, everybody interprets a personal relationship as being a private relationship. Mm. So they buy into the hyper-individuality. And I know in my own congregation, there are lots of good reflections going on about how do you change the discourse? Because that one isn't working.
Right. Yeah. No, thank you for that.
Yeah.
So we've been talking very much about this moment, the cross pressures of this moment, conversions in this moment, the life of congregations in this moment, what it is to be a Christian in Montreal today in the first quarter of the 21st century. And now I'd like to go back in time a bit to touch on some of the questions you explore in relation to the origins of Quebec and Montreal as colonial realities here in North America, and specifically to some of the initial communities that were also established here in those earliest years. And as you explore this, and as others explore it, there's a kind of contrast that is sometimes set up between two forms of life in early Montreal. On the one hand were the political, military, and economic origins and realities of the city, the colonial nature of the beginnings, as these might be represented by, for example, Samuel de Champlain, who first arrives here around 1603, who's a key figure in those early years of establishing a viable colonial presence. And on the other hand, there is this pattern and way of life that seems quite different. As an example, there is the Congregation Notre-Dame. And this is a community of sisters that's established by Marguerite Bourgeois in 1658. It was dedicated, among other things, to the education of children, education of indigenous peoples. And obviously, you can't pull apart the political, economic, and military realities on one side from other forms of community life as they existed at the time. But you have this interesting quotation from Jonathan Laney, a curator over at the McCord Museum, about 700 meters from where we are right now. And I think there are a series of things we could talk about that come out of this question that Laney raises. And he asked this when he was talking to you. What would have happened if those people had arrived before Champlain? What if they had shown up in a context where the pre-existing balance was still there? What if they came then with their very humanistic values, their spirit of collaboration? I think the course of history could have been very different. He seems to be saying that if Marguerite Bourgeois and her like-minded colleagues had been primary at the time, then perhaps the political, economic, and military dimensions, the colonial effort, would have been more secondary or even peripheral. I know that's hard to imagine, but we can think about it, right? And if we did, if this was a possibility, we would have had a very different history, both with the indigenous peoples and in the formation of culture and community in what this city has been and become. And it's such an interesting question Laney is asking, and I thought we could explore it or a few themes from it that arise from the question he's asking. And the first theme is the theme of imagination. Laney seems to be asking us to imagine an alternative history. Of course, this is kind of common. We all ask that question, what would have happened if? And it takes some imagination to think about an alternative history, an alternative community life, an alternative Quebec, an alternative Montreal, if someone like Marguerite Bourgeois or a similar community had been more important for the formation. And on this theme of imagination, it similarly seems that being a Christian in Montreal today, or being the church in Montreal today, requires an immense exercise in imagination. This means looking back, asking about how things could have been done differently, but it also involves looking forward. How do we live faithfully in this moment today, in the time that we've been given here? To live faithfully as the church seems to hinge on just this kind of exercise in imagination. Even without looking back, we can wonder, how can we live in our city differently today? How can we say yes to the city? How can we love the city? So I guess, again, being faithful seems to require imagination, creativity. And this is, again, another open-ended kind of question. But what place do you think imagination has in our being faithful in Montreal today?
Roland, it's a wonderful question when you go back to that time period, because it's important to realize that when Jacques Cartier came here in 1538, and I mean, you and I are sitting 250 meters from the monument to probably where Teotihuacan was founded when Cartier came in 1538. Samuel de Champlain shows up in 1608, and there are no indigenous peoples on this island. So it begs the question, what happened? And I think that's what's going on in Jonathan's mind. I had an immense amount of pleasure in learning about Jeanne Mance, about Marguerite Bourgeois, the first Canadian writer, Marie Morin. These were wonderful women, and I think that's what captured Jonathan's mind. But what you need to remember is those first 41 colonists, there was only one priest amongst them. They were all lay leaders. Jeanne Mance was not a Roman Catholic sister, so she was not cloistered. Marguerite Bourgeois was a sister, but insisted on being decloistered. And what was interesting to me is what Jonathan picks up on. These were incredibly down-to-earth Christian people. Now, our imagination wants to forget some things, and so that's where the founding documents come in. The two founding documents, the first one was called Dessin, which was probably written by Jean-Jacques Ollier about what was behind. And then there's the document Véritable Motif, which was an apologetic for coming to Montreal. And that was probably written as well for Bishop Laval, because he didn't want them to come here. He wanted them to go to Ile d'Orléans. So there's everything that's countercultural and institutionally countercultural in how Montreal started. But to think that Montreal had a hospital, Hôtel Dieu, and a school before it had a church building. And so that was the lay orientation. But that was all part of the Roman Catholic Reformation going back to François de Sales. So I think as Christians, if we want to recapture imagination, we need to go back and recapture history and to be rooted not just in our orthodoxy, but in the history of our orthodoxy, and to let it capture us. And we got to think outside the lines. That's what these people did. Now, unfortunately, they were geographically ignorant. They were meteorologically naive, and they were incredibly unfunded. And if it hadn't been for Jeanne Mance and Madame Bouillon, who was their philanthropist, this thing would have never survived beyond 1658. And that's where the Jesuits, France created the 100 Associates, and the Suppletions came in and salvaged this because it was bankrupt. So imagination has to have an immense amount of realism. Now, I tend to think that the people that get nostalgic about what if, they forget that these people were deeply committed to the scriptures and to Jesus. And this was a missionary movement from the very start. So that's what makes it really fun. But I think the only way to recapture imagination is to go back to some of the poetry, some of the singing, some of the fiction literature, the fine arts, the paintings, and to be reminded about what's going on and catching what is true about the human person. We're not just a head. We're human. We're whole persons.
Right.
In community.
And in a way, that's, I suppose, what the chapter written by your daughter, Krista is about, right? It's about more than just this intellectual, theological reflection. It's about imagination through the arts. Do you want to just say a little bit more about that chapter and why it's there?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Two of my three daughters help me on different parts of the book because they have a lot more expertise in these areas and in urban mission than I did. So Krista had done her doctorate on the arts in Montreal. And so she went back and did some of her semi-directed interviews with artists. And what really captured her in that chapter was the extent to which artists who take a much more holistic view of life and of faith are having an impact as artists in the urban culture. And so I find that chapter really, it was fun to work with her. It was fun to do the final edits with her. But I think that's a chapter that can have a great impact, because I do find that in all of our Christian traditions, Catholic, mainline Protestant, evangelical, and the Orthodox, all of a sudden we're realizing this is a great art city. And maybe we connect with people not through the spoken or the written word alone, but through the arts. And so I think it's a great chapter, and it's got a lot of could have great import, in my opinion.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I should probably add to that.
Yeah.
It would have been absolutely incredulous for me to turn in a manuscript about Montreal that didn't have something on the arts.
Right.
So, fair enough.
Yeah. I also want to pick up then on a word you just mentioned. So moving beyond imagination. So yeah, Lainey gives this quote that's about imagination, right?
Yeah,
it's about how can we think differently? How can we imagine things differently? And as you're saying, let's do it with a bit of realism thrown in. let's not be naive, I suppose. But I also want to raise this question that using that word that you mentioned, which is the word nostalgia. So often when we look back to things from the past, we look back not necessarily with that intention of imagination, as you've described it, not with the hope that we can imagine a new way of being followers of Christ in the world today, and not even calling into question the ways that we've lived in the past. But we do it with a high degree of nostalgia. It's interesting, you have this chapter on Expo 67, your purpose in sharing that is about the spirit of ecumenism that was built and then persisted following that time period. But it's interesting to me that so much of what I've heard in my mainline Protestant context, Expo 67 marks a kind of end point of the Quebec that Anglo community knew, right? And there's a kind of sense of loss even. So there's a celebration and a loss that somehow goes together when they talk about Expo 67. But in any case, the question of nostalgia becomes an important one, because nostalgia maybe is the enemy of imagination. So it's easy to look back and say, if only, right? What have we lost? Look at everything we've lost. And on the mainline Protestant side, I think the nostalgia is often a backward-looking nostalgia. If only we could reclaim something of what we've had. I think on the evangelical side, both maybe for Francophones and Anglophones, you can tell me what you think. There's a kind of forward-looking nostalgia. There's a wishing or a pining for some ideal circumstance for the church and for the culture. And if only we could achieve that reality for the church and for our society, we'd be better. But it does seem like nostalgia is the enemy of imagination.
Yeah.
And we're so inclined or toward this nostalgia. So what do you think is the answer to this? How do we at least find ways to resist that nostalgia, whether it's backward looking or forward looking for the church?
I think there's two things we have to keep in mind on this. Taylor in A Secular Age really attacks the secularization thesis, because most people say the decline or the marginalization of the church is because of secularization. Hmm. And I admit very openly in the first couple chapters of the book that a lot of my training was done in secularization. If you go back in my writings, I was talking about it. And then there were some things that, imagination. There were some things that didn't fit with reality. And so I had to think differently. But Taylor does an interesting thing. He uses the image, and so for our listeners, picture in your mind a three-storied triplex, which Montreal's got a ton of them with iron railings. So if you think about that, and you think on the main floor, that's the decline of the number of people who self-identify and practice their faith. Mm. Okay, that's reality. We that's acceptable. So then we got to say why. So what was we come down to the first floor, or the ground level, and we try to look at the reasons. And that's where the secularization thesis comes in, and the words pour on and on and on. And then there's the top floor. And the top floor is the one that interests me. How are Christians living their faith today in the eminent frame? So I tried to get at, how do Christians understand this? And this is where the nostalgia comes in. Roman Catholics continued to tell me in the interviews, oh, you know, back then we didn't have sexual abuse. Oh, we should have never done the residential schools. Now, I had to remind them, there were only 8 of them in Quebec, okay? So we're not talking about a huge phenomenon. You know, one was too many. But from our Mohawk sisters and brothers, Christians, I was really surprised how many of them said, the reason there's decline is because we took religion out of the schools. The point being is that how you define the reasons for what's going on the main floor then affects your imagination.
Right.
And so therefore, a lot of Protestants, English Protestants, would tell me, well, it's all because we elected the PQ in 76 and the Exodus, as if, you know, the PQ is stronger than the Spirit of the living God. But even evangelicals, they can't get their heads around what's going on in culture. So that's where I think ethnography comes in. And when we listen to stories of what people are living, all of a sudden we're saying, wait a minute, they might be nostalgic, but my goodness, do they know how to love Jesus and love their neighbors and love their boroughs, and they're doing things. And I would point out good stories to pastors and church leaders, and they would say, yeah, it's true. I guess we're not totally dumb.
Right.
So we're really caught because of the nostalgia. And so that's why I wanted to tell a different story.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's a really good stuff going on out there.
Yeah.
Now, we're smaller, but it's much more robust.
Yeah. It's interesting. The when I served as a pastor in NDG here, twigged on a memory for me. I was there for 7 years at Kensington Church in NDG, a church that in many ways was in that typical Anglo mainline narrative of decline. They would tell stories, some of the older folks, less so now, but they would tell stories about how Sunday by Sunday through the 70s, even up to the 80s, they had goodbyes for families every week, right? There were families moving to Ontario, Sun Life moves its headquarters, RBC, like this is the narrative of decline, the rise of the PQ, the referendum. So this is the narrative. In addition to which, there's this whole narrative of, well, nobody believes us anymore. Yeah. We can't hold this faith anymore. And so that narrative becomes so dominant for us. And often people want to ask the question, well, why? And they're looking for someone to blame, but there's no one to blame. Like, it's this whole set of circumstances that have come to prevail that we can't really explain, and no one can be held responsible for. But in the middle of all this, something happens, which is a young woman starts coming to Kensington Presbyterian Church. I mean, this tells you something about me and about the Presbyterian Church here in Montreal. But a young woman comes who's been hearing about Jesus from a friend of hers, who's been growing in her faith for a period of time, who's resistant to so much of what's happening in the culture in terms of acquisitiveness and consumerism, just wants to live a different life, comes to faith in Jesus and wants to be baptized. And she comes, and I say, well, you're going to have to come and meet with the elders and share your story. And that sharing of that story was immensely countercultural for that body of elders.
Yeah.
Wow, there is still someone who wants to become a Christian. There's still someone who wants to be baptized. What? So there has got to be a bigger story. I was reminded of it because of what you're saying, right?
Yeah.
We tell these big stories about decline, but then there are these moments that we get to see that say, no, that is not the story. The story is, as you say, that the Spirit of the living God is more powerful than the PQ or whatever narrative we're telling ourselves. So it's a powerful...
Well, all of those things, and I mean, even today now, the whole laïcité thing in Quebec, you know, the Minister of Education saying, well, you can pray, but you have to do it in your head. You know, those are cross pressures, okay? And unfortunately, we accept those. But again, your story just reminded me of something that happened to Sandy and me this summer. We've lived in our house for 40 years. The family that lived across the street from us, Sandy and I, we lived our faith. We tried to bear witness to Jesus and all of his teachings and word and deed. And this summer, Sandy has stayed in touch with Jocelyne. And Jocelyne came back to tell us that she had gone through divorce. So she decided to go back to the parish in the neighborhood. The priest gave a homily on Palm Sunday that touched her deeply. She got involved in an Alpha group and is now leading Alpha in her parish. That was 38 years of just praying for her and walking with her. It's conversion. It just takes a long time. But I think we, again, like I said, we get muzzled. Right. And so we don't take the fact that God is at work. And he wants to use us right where we live, where we work, where we play with our families. That's what Christians in Montreal are living.
Yeah,
today.
And how to articulate that with confidence, notwithstanding the cross pressures or apart from them, right?
Oh, so right.
Somehow finding ways to name that confidence.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
I thought maybe we could end with a couple of questions or maybe even just one question around the place where we're sitting right now, the Presbyterian College.
Yeah, right. Obviously,
that's of interest to me because I'm the principal of the Presbyterian College. But the more I've read about the history of this college, the more and as I have put that into dialogue with the work and the history that you've articulated in the book and that some others, Richard Lougheed and others, have written as well. It's interesting the ways that this college overlaps with almost all of it.
Yeah.
You described the reality of French theological education at the end of the 19th century into the beginning of the 20th century. You talk about the decline of French theological education in the beginning of the 20th century because of increasing resistance to the idea of proselytizing.
Yeah.
It's true that the focus on French theological education among Presbyterians had a very anti-Catholic spirit, and that's expressed in this character, Shinnecke. So we've got this whole story, and then you've got the decline, in a way, of the college with the decline of the Anglophone Presbyterian presence in the city of Montreal. If we went right back to the beginning, the college is founded by these wealthy Scottish industrialists. So, like, you've got the whole history of Montreal expressed in the life of this college, which is more and more astonishing to me the more I think about it. But we also have this more recent history, which is in many ways initiated by yourself, which is the establishing of a French language master's in theological studies and practical theology. And so it's like turning over a new leaf, but it's also trying to reclaim something in a new mode, right? So it's about acknowledging we had a history in French theological education and acknowledging what was then cannot be today. That was a century ago. It ended a century ago. And so now trying something fresh and new. And one of the challenges is bringing together distinct, diverse communities, right, in theological education. So we have our traditional Anglophone theological programs affiliated with McGill, and then we've got this whole new cohort of students who have many of them speak English, many of them are connected to English dimensions of the city of Montreal or more broadly in Quebec. So there's not hostility or alienation or anything of that nature, but they're still distinct communities, right? And bringing them together in theological education is a challenge and is also something that just is going to take a lot of time. So I, at the beginning, I thought, okay, how are we going to do this? And I've just released that pressure from myself, right? This is not something that is accomplished in a few years, right? These are long historical trends.
Yeah, right.
But I guess the question for me is, what do you think? And let's leave the negative aside. Yeah. Let's just focus on the positive, which is what is perhaps the biggest gift that comes out of this possibility of this little Anglophone theological school with this complex history now connecting with practical theology with Francophone evangelical students? Like what is the best gift that comes out of that from your point of view?
Well, let's go back and use some imagination, but not nostalgia. It was fun for me to go back and to learn about the cohorts of Francophones that were studying at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. And there was not one French Protestant church in Quebec where the minister had not been educated here. So you had the Canadianization of Protestantism going on at that time period, and it was the college that was leading the charge. So they were taking culture seriously. I think part of the problem, certainly the anti-Catholicism was a court, and that was even with the industrialists that they had
they wanted to fund theological education to convert these Roman Catholics who they thought of as nothing more than pagans.
It was incredibly transactional.
Yeah.
But what struck me is that when church union took place, in 1925, interestingly, all of the French-speaking Presbyterian churches opted to go with church union.
Right.
But not all of the English Presbyterian churches in right. this presbytery. And within a matter of years, those French churches disappeared. Hmm. We began to think institutionally rather than thinking missiologically. Hmm. So I think today, how do we think missiologically? And how do we think, and how do we recruit and deploy students in our historic Orthodox posture, but take culture seriously? Because my fear is, as culture heads in one direction, the natural posture of a lot of churches is to go the other. I think when culture goes one way, the church needs to move into the middle. Take the middle and practice a principled pluralism, a robust Christian fellowship, respect diversity, but know who we are. Don't be afraid to say who we are. And that's why I think things like, an authentic spirituality, this principled pluralism. I have a concern right now, particularly in the more French-speaking evangelical congregations, that there's kind of a circling of the wagons around a lot of the issues around human sexuality and women in ministry. It doesn't come as any surprise to you because you meet them, Roland. But a third of our cohort are women now because they're finding a place where they can be valued for their giftedness and that they can learn in a rigorous fashion and then practice their vocation. So I think we need to be bold going ahead, but we need to think missionally. If we start thinking too institutionally, history tells us what'll happen.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. In a way, I think what you're saying, you had this one phrase, and it's kind of a throwaway phrase, but you speak about following Christ while living in the city.
Yeah.
And I think the while living in the city means not circling the wagons, exactly. right? It means being in the city, and it means loving the city and saying yes to the city.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Right. Knowing there are things we have to say no to.
Oh, exactly.
Right? But that's where imagination, that's where the missional orientation, but you can't have that imagination, that missional orientation without that fundamental yes to the city.
In our case,
to the city of Montreal.
Exactly. Yeah. I like to teach my students that there are lots of churches that practice their faith in the city. There are churches that practice their faith for the city, but we need to learn to think about how do we practice our faith with the city. So prepositions become important.
Yeah.
And it's the with that I think we need to do. But that means we want to read the Bible as an urban textbook, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Very good. I think that's the word, the preposition on which we can end our conversation with the city, which I think is a beautiful word. So thank you so much for the book. Thank you for the conversation. Thank you for the insight you bring both to the college and to the wider community, both here in Montreal, Quebec, Canada, and also in the global context. So thank you, Glenn.
Thank you very much, Roland. Great to do this with you.
Good. Okay.